This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
I vow to taste the truth and love the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to start by acknowledging and thanking my teachers, my root teacher, Seke Harada Roshi, and my practice teacher, Shosan Victoria Austin. And thank those of you here at Hartford Street Zen Center who invited me to be here. Thank all of you for being present, for taking care of your life in this way, of showing up to a Dharma talk. In Zen practice, we often speak about the study of the self. We speak about checking into our experience, our feelings, our thoughts. We study the way we eat, we study the way we speak. We study the breath, the way the breath breathes the body. And all the bodily sensations. And we inquire into what all of that means. But the fact is that if the study of the self begins and ends with this body and this mind, that will always be a limited view. That will always be a one-sided view. It will always be a biased view. And that's because this particular part of our study doesn't really fully encompass the true self. So some of you may be familiar with Dogen Zenji, who was the founder of the Soto School of Zen. This particular temple is in that school. I'm a student of that school. And Dogen wrote a lot about the study of the self. And in particular, he wrote a fascicle called Shinjin Gakudo, in Japanese, means mind-body study of the way. So a fascicle is just a very fancy term that we use for a book, a part of a book that is being published in parts. So something like a chapter or an article. And he wrote this fascicle in about 1242. in Japan after he'd come back from his study in China. And in this fascicle, he actually quotes another master. He quotes a Chinese Zen master named Chosa Keishin, who lived in Tang Dynasty, China, considered to be the sort of pinnacle of Zen practice, Tang Dynasty, China, which was about 8th, 9th century of the Common Era. So people who existed a long time ago. But Dogen quotes this Zen master as having said, "The true human body is the entire universe. The whole universe is within the luminosity of the self." The true human body is the entire universe, and you could equally say the true human mind. Because in Buddhism we understand body and mind to be inseparable. And interestingly, he makes that quote again. He uses that quote again a few years later in another fascicle called Shoho Jiso. All dharmas are real form, are physical form. So somehow this is an important point, but what is it for us to study? The true human body or the true human mind? What if you are so completely interconnected with all things that can be known and all things that cannot be known by humans? What if you are so completely interconnected to all those things that you can't find a permanent part about you? What if you are so completely defined by this temporal arising, this constant movement of all the things in the universe, that there isn't a core? How would you study that? Because wouldn't that be a world in which you personally are incredibly vast and incredibly fluid and connected? And I want to say a word about this word interconnected, so we use this word often as well. So interconnected as distinct from just connected. So it's not just that we are connected to other things, but that other things are also connected to us. And actually even that is a dualistic view, right? This is why Thich Nhat Hanh refers to it as interbeing, or you might say interexistence. That the very nature of us is intertwined with the very nature of other. So it's perhaps this sense of connectedness or intertwining, interexistence, that can help go beyond this limited view that we live in sometimes. And in particular, the importance of connection within community. Right? This is another topic that Dogen wrote a lot about, the importance of Sangha, the importance of community. And you know, this word community, or this idea of community, is really a buzzword these days. You know, it's something that you might be able to read a lot about or to hear a lot about, right? We talk about the community of nations addressing climate change, we hope, addressing genocide. We talk about local communities, right? People petitioning for parklets and buying their food a little closer to home. And we talk about virtual communities, if that's really possible. So it's a little bit of a buzzword, but it is an important idea. It is an important fact of our lives that we do not live alone, even when we live alone. And I wanted to give you an example of how this might help us see the big picture. So, you know, there are various ideals that we sometimes talk about. And there's a story of a monk, and she was practicing in a cave. She was practicing patience for many, many years. She went up to the top of a mountain and really focused completely on the cultivation of patience for a long time. And then one day, another monk came by, and she saw the first monk sitting in the cave, and she said, "Hey, what are you doing in there?" And the first monk said, "Well, I've been here cultivating patience. I've been working on patience for years, really cultivating, deeply cultivating patience." And the passerby said, "Well, what's that good for?" And the first monk said, "Get the hell out of here!" Right? I apologize for those of you who've already heard that joke. It's one of my favorites. Why? Why? Because we can be so easily deluded by our own practice. We can be so easily caught into some narrow idea of what things are really like. This is also the reason why we have the tradition of transmission within Soto Zen. Because you might have some kind of incredible realization, but unless somebody else can mirror that in you, then maybe it's not as real as you think. So, just a word about what transmission means. But in any event, Sangha is very important. Community is very important. And yet Dogen says, you have to think even bigger than that if you're going to really study the true self. More poetically, he says, mountains, rivers, the earth, the sun, the moon are mind. Right? So we had the supermoon this week. So how many, did anybody get a chance to go out there and look at it? The moon is mind. The stars are mind. The sun is mind. So what is that mind that wants to know the true self? What is that mind that would like to experience the true self? That is Bodhi mind. Dogen talks about it in this fascicle as well. He talks about this phrase called Kano Doko. So it means it's translated in various ways. Let's see what this is. Nishijima and Cross do a really nice job of translating the Shobogenzo, because it's fairly literal, the translation that they use. And so in terms of study for us geeks, it's sometimes helpful. And they will actually talk specifically about translation of certain terms like this, because Kanodoko is a term, is a phrase that is used quite often. So they translated as sympathetic communication of the truth. But actually, so here's what the characters mean, a little bit about what the characters mean. So kano is responsiveness. And doko is two pieces, do of way, or sometimes also translated as truth. And ko, which means some kind of exchange. Some kind of, it says here, intercourse, interchange, or intersection. So some kind of interrelatedness. So this phrase taken together means the way in which relatedness responds, the way you might say, to condense it down into one word, English word, it might be something like resonance. That's the seed, or the echo, or the shadow, or the wisp of Bodhi mind. Right? It knows itself in the world. It knows itself in your body and your mind. A bit. Enough for you to get started. That's Bodhi mind is often associated with the beginning of the way. Dogen later said that actually it's not only the beginning, it's the whole way. In any event, so what this bodhicitta, bodhi mind, this mind that seeks to know the true self, has some resonance within the world with that which is actually the essence, more than what we can actually perceive. And certainly the other side of this is you can't deny particularity. There's no reason to deny particularity. There is a certain set of physical attributes that more or less hang together to make you. Right? There is an embodied existence. There is a consciousness that is full of these feelings and thoughts and speech. So there's no reason to deny that. And yet, it's a temporal arising. Right? It's a shifting thing. So to be bounded by your physical and your mental state, which is by its nature a shifting thing, must be a false view. Right? It must be somewhat mistaken. So you exist in this temporal physical sense as much as anything else does, which is to say, not much really. Not the way you think you do. So holding these two perspectives simultaneously is what we would call right view, or perhaps more appropriately translated as a sound view. These two aspects, right, of the vastness and the specificity, of the, actually both of those two things reflected in each other. Right, so wave on the ocean realizes wave, realizes ocean. So holding this sound view can help bring you into harmony with your true nature, with the true nature of reality. Even if you might have some aversion to what's going on or some attraction to what's happening, there can be a harmony. So this interdependence or this interexistence of all things has a lot of implications for us. In particular, it implies that what you do matters. Actually, everything you do matters because it is affecting all of the universe. It is affecting everything else that you're connected to, and that's connected to you. What you do really does matter. It impacts many, many other things. You know, a student of mine in Dharma en Español, Spanish Dharma group, brought up seeing the stars. You know, so the light hits our eye and there are the stars, and perhaps that star is already gone, actually. And yet it's still having its impact. It's still having its effect on the world, on you, in that moment. So one other aspect that I'd like to focus on today, before I go off of that, let me also say that it's also important to remember that what you do matters, because I think it's also easy to feel overwhelmed. To feel overwhelmed by the teaching of how vast the self is, this task that we've set before us. To feel overwhelmed by the amount of activity in our lives. Or to feel simply too small. But Suzuki Roshi had a very interesting way of talking about this. He used a quote from the Lotus Sutra. And he would say, "Shine one corner of the world. Just to shine one corner is enough." You know? He'd always use that phrase. You know? Just to shine one corner is enough. So one other aspect that I want to bring out about this teaching is that this view also of inner existence or inner penetration also implies that there's a lot more to life than meets the eye. So this is not a mystical view. This is not mysticism. This is saying that we acknowledge that the human sense realm is limited, and we also recognize that what it means to be human is greater than that. It reminds me of a teaching that Harada Roshi would often give. So, you know, we would have people come from all over the world to this little town called Obama, Japan, to sit sesshin with Roshi. And at the end of the sesshin, not long, 5 days probably, usually, Roshi would give a very brief talk, and he would say, "For those of you who do not live here at the monastery, when you go home, I want you to forget all about Zen. Just forget about it." And for some people, they were very disconcerted about that statement. Like, wait, I flew all the way, you know, halfway across the world. I learned this very elaborate ritual to eat. Right? I came to hear your teaching, this teacher's teaching, and yet I should forget all about it. And other folks were just totally relieved. Like, oh my gosh, this has been really hard, and I'm not sure I understood what was said, and I'm just perfectly happy to think about forgetting everything. But I would argue that either one of those two views is probably missing the point of what Roshi was saying. Because what Roshi is actually pointing at is that Zen is already your life. It's not something you could just add to your agenda. You know, like mindfulness. Like, there's a way that you could say, yeah, you're going to pay a little bit more attention. And yet, if you don't pay attention until there's no one who pays attention, then it's simply another form of dualistic view. So Zen is your life. And even so, just saying that doesn't really cut it. Right? You can't just say, we're all Buddhas and everything's okay, and we're all already previously enlightened. In fact, Dogen again says in this fascicle, it's a very interesting fascicle if you get a chance to read it, or at least I think so. He says, he quotes Yakujo. So Yakujo is not often quoted in Soto Zen because he's a Rinzai master originally, sort of, more in that lineage. But he quotes Yakujo to say, that's naturalism, this idea that we are all already Buddha. In English, we might say it's Pollyanna. Right? Some effort is required. So the practice doesn't come into being. The experience of resonance of Bodhi mind doesn't come into being unless the effort is there, unless the awareness is there, unless the embodied experience is there. That's why we do what we do. And by making effort, then, our bodies and minds, these limited perceptual realms, become the vehicles for transformation. They become the vehicles for that which is beyond. And that's important to remember, because without that context, we are simply swirling around in our the world of our own biases and our own psychology and our own history and neurosis and stress and bliss and joy and preferences. And all that swirling around, there's nothing wrong with it. But just abiding there won't lead you to liberation. The Buddha was very clear about that. And I think Dogen's also very clear about that. So just to sum it up, Dogen states, neither the great elements nor the smallest particles can be wholly realized by the common person. Neither the great elements nor the smallest particles can be wholly realized by the common person, but they are mastered in experience by the sages. They are mastered in experience. Along similar lines, Harada Roshi says, this thing, and he would pat his chest very firmly. I can't do it like that. This thing, which you think is yourself, is neither you nor anyone else. Suzuki Roshi says even more succinctly, don't be bothered by your mind. And I would add, just don't be defined by your mind. That's my comments for today. Open to receiving some comments or questions, anything you'd like to share. Yes.
Yes, thank you for the elucidations here. Dhamma. Appreciated with this reaffirming this sort of the quality, from what I perceive, of emptiness of the self. And at the same time, there was, for me, this bristling that came up with language can often be so dualistic. And so when it was cut and dry of like saying that's false, this is true, it just it seemed to have a dissonance from that experience of the interrelatedness of being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, for example, the joke, but we're appreciated, and certainly I've been there with my own delusion, and then sort of the greater reality is like, oh my gosh, you know, here I was thinking this, and it's like I'm so off base. And yet, I wonder if you can comment that, putting the joke aside, that her practice was practice of patience. Clearly she was still, as we're all just sort of moving along, just doing a little bit more, a little bit more. And then there's this awakening of like, you see, and now, you see, I've come this far, and yet this being arises, this anger in me that, oh, you know, my study of patience is needing to be expanded, you know, that,
mm-hmm.
rather than false.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Thank you for the question. I absolutely don't want to say that there's anything wrong about going off and practicing by yourself, for example, right? Or about putting a lot of effort into one particular aspect, right? Or even having this kind of encounter, right?
Mm-hmm.
That suddenly turns something for you. I think that's equally important. I think it's equally important, right? Going back to the aspect of community or to Sangha, and that realization doesn't often just come out of nowhere. So it's false in the sense that, or let's say it's deluded more so than false. It's deluded in the sense that any sort of refinement of mind doesn't lead to true liberation. It's a refinement. It might lessen your suffering, right? But to think that one could simply, by sitting down and doing that kind of improvement, so to speak, would find something else, it's difficult, I think, difficult. So maybe that's a different way, a slightly different way to turn it. Yeah? More than false or true, because we do speak about right view or not right view.
Yes. Yes,
but
of course.
But it's more it's more nuanced than that, right? It's how do we delude ourselves, or how do we turn even something as wholesome as the Dharma into a tool for not quite really surrendering to something.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
I thought too, I really appreciated that joke, but I thought also, this is not that individual pursuit can be helpful, but that it can get skewed when you're not relating to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that I thought, if I remember that, that joke came up in the context of talking about the importance of Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, yeah, that there's something special about that. And also, you know, I don't know what else to say about it. I thought it was a very funny joke.
Thank you. And the opposite can also happen, right? The other side can happen, which is that the Sangha does mirror something that changes in you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the Sangha could, somebody in the Sangha could come up and say, wow, you know, I really noticed how you were so mindful with this, you know, how you held the incense today. Right? So, that too. Yes?
That's the first time I heard the joke. I like it. And it does resonate with me in that there, you know, me included, there are people who are so dedicated to the practice. No matter what the practice is, it doesn't have to be Buddhism or meditation, some type of practice, so dedicated to it and feel so enriched by it while practicing, but leave it just doing the practice and not carry that on, you know, on a ongoing manner. Like, you know, you're good, you practice, you feel virtuous, but then you do forget,
mm-hmm.
and you're not careful with your words,
mm-hmm.
you're not careful with your actions, and you do not carry that and be careful about how your actions impact others.
Yes.
But you don't feel bad about your actions because you take refuge in the fact that you're virtuous because you practice. So it does resonate with me, and I think
mm-hmm.
that's right. I think
yeah.
it's the delusion. And it's something that's nice to hang on to say that I am a pious person, I'm a virtuous person, but do forget that your actions and your words do impact others outside of your
yeah.
of what you practice, yeah, what you pursue.
So in essence, you are whatever that thing that you behave as, right, is what it comes back to. So in the moment that you're a patient person, you're a patient person. In the moment that you're an impatient person or an angry person, that's what you are in that moment, right? It reminds me also of this, what you were saying about put it down. It reminds me also of, there's a wonderful koan of a monk, and I believe it's Joshua is the master, or I can't recall now if it's Joshua is the master or Joshua is the student, but I'm pretty sure it's Joshua is the master, and one of the monks comes to him and says, I've set everything down. I've given everything up. I've turned it all over. And the master says, okay, now put that down. And the monk says, well, how can I put down, I'm not carrying anything. And the master says, well, if you really feel like you need to hang on to it, I guess you're gonna have to. You know what I'm saying? That even that, we can even get hung up on, you know, I've done it, I've given it over, right? So, yeah, good point. How are we doing for time, folks? I'm not a good timekeeper, so. Well, we have a few more minutes, 3 more minutes, so maybe another question or two. Yes?
Hi. Thank you for your share. I really appreciate the way you speak. It's quite meditative for me.
Thank you.
I have a question. We're talking about interrelation.
Mm-hmm.
Interrelation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's a good question or not, but it's a question that really I try to find an answer about that. Just how could you define a self in a subculture like here?
How can you define a self in the subculture?
Yes, like
mm-hmm.
for example, San Francisco. It's a special community too.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I would say, what is the self of that moment, right? What is the self that finds itself in this place, with these people, in this climate, and so on? Yeah. So part of the implication, and this is probably too big a topic to get into right now, but just to touch on it, part of the implication also of this teaching is identity. Right, so if you establish identity up front, and then it becomes a boundary, or it becomes a box, or it becomes some kind of fixed view that again tends to constantly be getting out of sorts with reality and creating some conflict. And again, that's part of what our tendency is oftentimes, right? But if identity becomes retrospective, so to speak, if identity is what happened in this moment, or what is happening in this moment, then it's fluid enough that it's totally there for whatever is happening. So in this subculture, the same thing, right?
So it's just like the identity is like a particle self, but there's also a more nuanced wavelength self going on.
Yeah, you could put it that way. You could certainly put it that way. I mean, the Dogen's teaching of time is that each instant contains all of the results of all of the infinite past, right? And all of what's needed for an infinite future. So if we look at that logically, we say what's happening right now has to have been possible in the previous moment. Otherwise it wouldn't be here, right? So the self is that way, right? The identity is that way. Yeah.
The self, as I understand it, is an illusion. That it's not real. Am I correct?
The small self.
Huh?
The self that you construct, the boundary that you draw
in the head, you know,
in the head,
the
brain, right,
brain
right,
dissolves, self
it's
dissolves.
It's real in the sense that it's experienced, right? It's arising. There's a physical body, there's a thought, there's a feeling. All of that stuff is real. We're not going to say that it's not happening.
Okay, go ahead.
But that doesn't define you. The whole universe is the true self, right? So any self that's short of everything is missing part of the picture. So the self is even the true self, right, is instantaneous. It's a temporal arising. It's completely fluid.
So there is the self,
mm-hmm.
which is an illusion, and there is the true self, which is not.
Which is all things.
Which is all things.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean,
something
the,
to work with.
The self, I'm pretty much down with, you know? Comes into being, in the brain dissolves, self dissolves. You know, sort of thing. So I can see how that is, in a sense, non-lasting or non-real, in a sense.
Well,
to
me that sounds like a consciousness, right?
Consciousness, yes.
So I make a distinction between self and consciousness.
There's a difference between consciousness and self?
Sure.
And that difference would be?
The self is all things. It must include that consciousness, and it must include everything else. Otherwise it's not a real self, right?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise it is just kind of a flicker.
Okay, that's helpful.
Okay.
I'll meditate upon that.
Sure. Great.
Thank you.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha.
Thank you.